Can We Talk with Debbie Georgiatos?
Honestly, Austin is kind of like the San Francisco of Texas. It's just radically left. And so you have this prosecutor, Jose Garza, who decided not to prosecute anyone else who surrounded Daniel Perry's car, not to prosecute the individuals who were behaving in a threatening manner, and not even to prosecute the person who fired a gun at and hit his car, Daniel Perry's car, but instead just chose to, he did get a grand jury indictment, but he chose to go to a grand jury with this plan to prosecute Daniel Perry for murder, and he did receive he was indicted by that grand jury. Part of what we'll be talking about, which is among the many bases of appeal that should be successful if we can count on a rule of law in the Texas courts, part of the basis of the appeal relates to a decision that was made by this Soros-funded prosecutor, Jose Garza, to withhold certain evidence from the grand jury and ultimately from the jury itself. And this evidence, to use one of my, I used to work in a big law firm, and one of my partners, one of his favorite terms is, isn't that dispositive? I mean, doesn't that solve the whole thing? And it did. If you used to hear what was withheld from the jury by this lead prosecutor and withheld at the direction and instruction of this Soros-funded DA, I think that alone is grounds for the reversal. A couple other quick things before we get into talking with Mrs. Perry. One is that at the federal level, we talked many, many times in the cases involving January 6th defendants who are being prosecuted in federal court. So in Washington, D.C., federal court prosecutions over January 6th, many references to the Brady Rule. The Brady Rule emerged as a matter of interpreting constitutional law under the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution, which basically is an amendment that tells you you have a right to a fair trial. And then that right to a fair trial is embellished with all sorts of details. You know, an actually competent counsel, an impartial jury, many other things are required. The Brady Rule, which is absolutely in place in federal litigation, federal prosecutions, basically says if you are the prosecutor and you have information, the term is exculpatory. If you have information, if you have evidence that is exculpatory, meaning if it would cause a jury certainly if it would prove the innocence of the person that you are prosecuting, but even less than that, it doesn't have to prove their innocence, just evidence that would be relevant to a jury's consideration of whether or not to convict someone on one or more charges with which they are charged, you have a duty as the prosecutor to turn that evidence over to the defense lawyers. You have a duty to have the defense lawyers be given that information. But that's federal court. So here in the great state of Texas, I went to the Texas Bar website today. The Texas Bar Rule 3.09D, if you want to look it up yourself, I don't think I linked this on the website, but I could. Texas Rule 3.09D, Texas Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct, and 3.8D, Model Rules of Conduct. Short story is, Texas claims that they actually have a strict rule about Brady, a bigger obligation, a broader obligation of prosecutors to share evidence with the defense about what they know about this case that could be exculpatory, could help get somebody else, really what it is to give the defendant a fair trial, which is required by the Sixth Amendment. The last thing I'll do before turning to Mrs. Perry is, you may see the argument made on all sorts of social media. I see it too. You see the argument made that, and the conservatives will say, you know, somehow we have a horrible justice system, but this justice system is off track because we have all of these, you know, January 6th defendants who did little more than go to Washington, D.C. and stand on public property and, you know, pray for their country, or, you know, showed up and went in the Capitol because the doors were being held open by police officers. Those people are being prosecuted, I mean, with a vengeance that is unparalleled in American history. Over 1,000 people prosecuted in Washington, D.C. by the DOJ. Another 1,000 promised by the DOJ still coming. And yet you see all the Black Lives Matter protests that occurred around 2020, all over America, 2021, and Antifa protests, and very little. It seems like the standard of justice is different as to what gets you prosecuted. And then you will see arguments, and the reason I wanted to raise this is, you will see arguments, you see headlines online when you try to research saying That's not true. You know, there were thousands of arrests related to, you know, these protests. Thousands of protesters of January 6th, people got arrested. And it's one of those things that's technically true, but it's a lie. Because what they did, the prosecutors did, in many cases, the police did, was they arrested people. So there were a fair number of arrests, not as many as would have happened had the protesters been conservatives, but there were a fair number of arrests. But what happened was, after the arrests are taken off the streets, and then the prosecutor declines to file charges, to press charges, the police conclude it was a bad arrest, shouldn't have done that, let them go. The point is, the number of prosecutions leading to actual jury trials, convictions, and jail time is starkly different between people who did basically nothing wrong January 6th and people around this country who engaged in astonishing levels of violence, which our country just decided to tolerate. And that whole attitude spilled over even into way local DAs chose to interact, chose to file charges, especially now in this case. We're going to turn to Mrs. Perry and what happened to her son in Austin on July, it was on July 25th, 2020, a Black Lives Matter protest was unfolding in the city of Austin. Quick before I bring Mrs. Perry on, Mr. Emilio, I sent you, you have those clips? Okay, I just want to show you a picture of what Austin looked like. This is not the incident involving Daniel Perry, but just what the streets of Austin looked like in this protest in July of 2020.
Downtown that weekend.
35 in downtown, so, oh, there you go. There you heard another firework right there.
Started late Friday night when a crowd unexpectedly showed up.
You are taking a live look at the headquarters there. The windows are all boarded up this morning.
Since we've been here, the crowd has doubled and maybe even tripled.
There's a lot of problems that's consistently happening to us, and we're tired of being ignored.
There have been a number coming here to join the protest, spreading all
the way. They are now on the main lanes of Interstate 35.
This video you're seeing here was pretty earlier in the day. Many of the protests started peacefully with a clear message of hope. But as the day wore on and the sun went down, tensions rose. A car under I-35 downtown and a dumpster on 6th Street were both lit on fire last night. And then people started looting a business on 6th Street.
So that was what was happening in Austin in 2020. Now I'd like to introduce and welcome to our show Mrs. Rachel Perry. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Mrs. Perry. Thank you for being here. I know you were not, up until this time, a person politically active, involved in all this or not, but your son, Daniel Perry, was involved in an incident in Austin in July, on July 25th of 2020. We're going to go into what happened in his case and whether America and the state of Texas complied with the basic standards we require in terms of fair treatment and fair trial. But let's just start with, tell our listeners a little bit about your son, like his background before this incident.
My son, he has been an Eagle Scout. He did that before the age of 18. He was kind of aimless as reached adulthood. He went to college for 2 years, and then we decided to kind of make him make a decision about his future, and he decided to join the military. And he's been in the military 12 years. He was currently active duty when this incident happened. He has never had any incidents, violent incidents in his history. He's never been in protests. He's never been, you know, just against violence, period, and looting. And I truly believe that he's innocent. He's just self-defense. The whole incident is just about self-defense.
The whole case is about self-defense. I do want to, so very quickly, so your son, where he was, he was still in the military,
yes.
Active military, that's an
yes.
Army. And how many years had he been?
12 years.
12 years. And he was stationed at or based in a nearby
Fort Hood,
but not living on the Fort Hood premises.
No, he wasn't living on premises. They messed up his pay. And so to earn extra money, because they didn't have any housing on the post, they messed up his pay, so he had to earn extra money, and he decided to go Uber. Now, Killeen is not a good place to make money, so he decided to go to Austin. And he's been doing this. He's done it previous weekends, and he was just basically going up there for the weekends to be an Uber driver.
Okay, so he's still in the military. He's
yes.
Uber driving at night to make extra money. kind of bad if our military has to earn extra money. That's something wrong with that. But I do want to get into what happened that day. So on July 25th, 2020, and I know, let me just say, I've acknowledged to our audience that this gentleman, Daniel Perry, was convicted involving a shooting which appears from the facts I can tell and what you hear from Mrs. Perry to have been utterly done in self-defense, normally never charged, and certainly not in the great state of Texas. But he was charged and ended up being convicted, a guilty verdict, on April 7th of this year, 2023, and sentenced to 25 years. So I want to get those facts out. And now I want to go back and talk about, have you tell, just because you attended the trial, listened to the evidence, what happened that day from his perspective?
My son, he was dropping off people and picking people up. He had an incident where he picked up this lady from a previous ride, and he dropped her off, and this lady was trying to solicit sexual favors from him. And so what she had, I know it's crazy, but she asked, you know, for $200, want to meet up. He said, yeah, sure, but for $200, no, I don't do that. And while he was texting her back, he made a turn onto Congress, not really paying attention to what was happening in front of him. And at that time, he ran into the protest.
Okay, let me back up. So he's driving the Uber, direction. But there's no other passenger in the car.
No.
Driving
by
the
himself.
Uber, going along, and he's texting, and
yes.
He made a turn.
Turned on the right. It was a red light, and he turned on red.
He turned right on red.
Okay. But he didn't stop, I don't think. But he turned right on red, and he was stopped because of the people, there were pedestrians that were in the road.
So and the pedestrians on the road were BLM protesters.
Yes, correct.
There was a big protest going on down there. Okay. So, and do you know from whatever you learned about it, do you know how fast he was going turning that corner?
He's going less than 6 miles an hour.
Less than six?
Yes.
Turning a corner, right on red, turn onto Congress. Okay. So he turns onto Congress, and there are Black Lives Matter protesters there.
He stopped because he saw pedestrians in front of him. And as he stopped, the car was surrounded. They were shaking his car.
The protesters were shaking his car.
They were beating on his car. They were kicking his car. And then out of the crowd came Garrett Foster carrying an AK-47 in a low-ready position. As he approached the vehicle, he was less than 18 inches away from the vehicle. He started rising his vehicle towards Daniel.
Rising his
AK-47, yes, towards Daniel. And Daniel saw that happening, and he took his gun and shot Garrett Foster.
Okay, let me just jump in. So you picture he's in the car. It's already been surrounded by protesters who are banging on the car, yelling at him. And I think you told me earlier, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Garrett Foster asked him to roll the window down?
Yes, correct. And he did.
So he rolled the window down in response. And I guess Garrett Foster, he wasn't sure at that point if Garrett Foster was a protester or a police officer?
Yeah, he was not sure. He was just approached by this guy in camouflage vest. He had a vest on him to protect himself, I guess, for weapons. As he approached him, Daniel saw that he had an AK-47 in a low-ready position pointing downwards, slinged across the front of him. As he raised the weapon slowly, Daniel panicked and shot this guy 5 times.
Okay. I want to get clear with something. The low-ready position. I'm not a gun person, really. I'm in favor of the Second Amendment. Love the Second Amendment. But so low-ready means that the AK-47 is over his shoulder and is pointed down.
Yes, his hands on the trigger.
But his hands on the trigger.
And the other hand on the barrel. And he was raising it up slowly.
Okay, raising it up slowly. And this is when your son, seeing this, and this guy was pretty much right outside the driver's window.
18 inches away.
18 inches away. You see someone with an AK-47. And you also, your son having military training, I've never had military training. I would assume they are taught to understand when they might be in danger.
Absolutely, because he did service in Afghanistan, Germany, and Poland prior to this.
Okay.
So he was ready. He was ready to protect himself and protect his comrades around him.
Okay, so I'm sorry I didn't mention that earlier. So his previous military service included Afghanistan and Germany and
Poland.
And Poland. Okay, so he's actually served America's military, still in the military, and down the Uber in Austin, he sees someone 18 inches away, AK-47, which is a very large weapon.
Yes.
And you use the term ready position, and that just means it's held in a way you're ready to use it if
Absolutely.
You're going to use it. So he sees the elbow moving?
The elbow was raised. This picture still photographs of Garrett Foster's elbow. The weapon must have been up in the air if the elbow was raised,
okay,
pointing towards my son.
And so your son then shot.
Yes.
Okay. And shot what he believed was self-defense.
Yes.
Appears it was. Okay, so then what happened?
And then my son, shortly after the shooting, the crowd dispersed. My son wanted to leave the area so he can call the police. As he was leaving the police, one of the protesters shot three times in his vehicle. This is, mind you, this car is like maybe 2.5, 3 months old. The vehicle that he actually, you know, had holes in it. He went around the corner and called the police and notified what actually happened.
Okay, so as your son's pulling away,
yes.
Shots are fired.
Yes.
Which, and then he pulls over and he calls the police.
Yes.
And so he basically wasn't trying to run and get
away.
No,
he wasn't.
He was turning himself, I'm not turning
sure.
himself in, he's letting the police know what happened.
Absolutely. And the police okay. came really shortly afterwards. They brought him in, they interrogated him, and then they released him. So he went back to the military, he went back to Alaska. He was transferred to Alaska at that time. And he has been in Alaska for about 2 years since the shooting. That's where he was stationed at.
So he was
in the Army.
They sent him back to Alaska. So the first round of the police investigating, they obviously
released
concluded
him.
Self-defense.
No, we had to pay for, of course, we had to pay for a bond to have him released.
Yeah.
And it was $300,000 bond that we had to pay for to get him released. And he was serving still in the military.
Okay. So then the next thing you, at some point, he's notified by this Soros-funded DA,
yes.
Jose Garza, that they are considering charges.
Yes, and then the grand jury was met by Zoom at that time. And after the grand jury, they indicted him for
and
murder.
The indictment, I looked up, indictment was July 2nd, 2021.
Absolutely.
So he's indicted then, and he finally went to trial in early this year, April
yes.
2023.
Yes.
Okay. And this jury in Austin convicted him on May 10th.
Absolutely. No, May 7th, I think. May 7th, Friday.
Okay. I don't know. Anyway,
before Easter.
I'm getting at the point that it was, at least at the time of the questioning, when he turned himself in
yes.
the police, they didn't say, you know, they didn't charge him then. They didn't, I mean,
no.
It was a decision, it appears, that, you know, this was an unfortunate incident, but appears to have been self-defense.
Yes.
Correct. Okay.
Absolutely. The police all say it was self-defense. Detective Fugit said it was self-defense.
But we're going to get into Detective Fugit in just
yes.
one moment. Okay. So I want to be sure on those facts, and you, I think you told me earlier, but just to be clear, in this instance, you had police, you had protesters rocking the car.
Yes.
You saw the videos earlier, mobs in the street rocking the car, and they ended up having a... and what we just described occurred. Yeah. Do you know if any of the individuals who surrounded his car and were smashing on his car and hitting
yes.
the car, were any of them arrested?
No, none of them were arrested. Not even the man that shot at his car, three bullets.
Not even the one who shot the car after he pulled
after
away?
After he pulled away.
Okay, so the only one involved in this is the one, it was your son, involved
That's
in
it.
Being charged was your son?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's my son.
Okay. And... You know, I think, you know, to my sense, I will tell you, I am a lawyer by background, but I never even pursued getting a license in the state of Texas. I got license in Washington, D.C., where I went to law school, California, where I was a litigator. I never did criminal law, but I did study criminal procedure and criminal law, and I've read a lot to prepare for today's interview, because I really want, I mean, I read enough to understand sure. some things were withheld from
Absolutely.
The jury
Absolutely.
To the point that they were not hearing, it's beyond exculpatory. To be really clear, the thing I was saying earlier, exculpatory evidence, it is the duty of the prosecutor to turn over
sure.
whether to the defense. But the Brady rule just relates to what you have to turn over. It doesn't relate to what the judge must rule
yes.
in the middle of trial as to whether something's admissible. So
yes.
do you know whether everything that this, so I'll quickly for our listeners, so there's the lead detective, David Fugit, lead detective in the Austin Police Department, who did the investigation, led the investigation, has come out after the trial to say that he was told by this prosecutor, by the Soros-funded Garza prosecutor, to withhold evidence from the grand jury. He was told to reduce the number of slides he created trying to present the case from 158 slides down to only 56 slides. So he's basically being told, as the police, the lead investigator, by the DA, don't let the grand jury see this.
Absolutely.
Now I'll take it off. So let's just, I mean, there were many, many things in the trial that were not admitted. and seemed to have resulted in kind of a, it seemed like a just determined prosecutor saying, I'm going to get this guy. And in fact,
absolutely,
didn't he run on that?
Yes, he ran on that. He ran on the fact that he's going to be getting justice for the Foster family.
This is the prosecutor who, because at the time the incident occurred,
yes,
Garza wasn't prosecutor.
No, he wasn't. The DA was going out, and he didn't want to deal with the case because his time was short.
So the outgoing DA didn't go for the case.
Yes.
Incoming DA, and he ran on, I'm going to get...
J&M Jewelry provides online jewelry appraisals that are convenient, secure, and affordable. Appraisals are usually completed within 48 hours and sent directly to your email. Contact us today or visit our website to use our appraisal request form. J&MJewelry.com.
This was made possible by Brighteon.com. After being deplatformed by YouTube, I built Brighteon.com so that we can speak. All voices of dissent are welcome. Join Brighteon.com now. Post your videos today and start building an audience there where you will not be censored. Brighteon.com.
The Kelley Key easily converts your AR rifle to bolt action, allowing you to keep the rifle you love in assault weapon jurisdictions. The Kelley Key is a true fast drop-in solution. No permanent changes to your rifle. Import, transport, own, and have fun with your AR. Why the Kelley Key? Because a bolt action is not an assault weapon. Stay future ready from gun bans with a Kelley Key. The Kelley Key also lets you quickly and easily build your ideal hunting rifle, lets you build a quiet a suppressed rifle, and benefits your long-range precision shooting. Available now at KelleyKey.com with free shipping.
The world we once knew is collapsing. We're being warned to expect rolling blackouts, and our political leaders are deliberately shutting down pipelines, fuel refineries, nuclear power plants, and energy exploration. The currency is collapsing, while financial assets are plummeting in value, and the global food supply is being deliberately decimated. To survive this war being waged on humanity, you need more than just regular prepping. You need resilient prepping. And that's the title of my new free audiobook, Resilient Prepping. You can download the entire audiobook and a printable PDF transcript for free right now at resilientprepping.com. Resilient Prepping teaches practical strategies for prepping in three layers: high-tech, low-tech, and no-tech. Resilient Prepping is your ultimate guide to surviving the total collapse of the world as we know it, because that's exactly what globalists are trying to achieve. Download this entire audiobook for free right now at resilientprepping.com. Nearly all the vitamin C sold at retail today comes from China, and it's made from genetically modified corn. Even though vitamin C is a critical part of immune support, it's also critical to know where your vitamin C comes from. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon and BrighteonStore.com. And we only sell non-China, non-GMO vitamin C. We then subject it to rigorous laboratory testing in our own food science lab, checking for heavy metals, glyphosate, as well as microbiological contamination.
Only be able to have a gun?
No, he wasn't. He actually lied in his application, that because the application clearly states that if you are using drugs or you have any history of mental illness,
yeah,
you are not allowed. And he did not answer the questions honestly. I'm not here to convict Garrett Foster. I'm just saying the facts that were withheld from the jury.
I was going to say that, yeah, relevant to us is the jury never heard about that.
Never.
Which would cause you to start to question, what was he thinking that day? You know, what was Garrett Foster thinking? How likely is it he might have lifted the AK-47 to aim at someone he doesn't know?
And there were previous incidences also that were withheld of him doing the same thing to other drivers, you know, through his history of marching, you know.
Okay, that's another, to repeat in case we're do not be clear, the gentleman who lost his life that day, Garrett Foster, also had done the same confrontational behavior to other drivers, other people, motorists going through, and
that was reported to the police department.
Reported to the police, but not admitted to the jury.
Correct.
And so if it was reported to the police, it's because drivers were saying this man behaved in a threatening manner.
Absolutely.
So the jury wasn't allowed to hear it. The same guy, they're trying to decide did he behave in a threatening manner, and they weren't allowed to hear he'd been doing that. I mean, I understand the legal weapon. Issues about whether that was, but I mean the idea that the jury couldn't get a picture.
No.
Yeah. Okay. I also want to on him. Same guy, Garrett Foster, the one who was killed that day. He also had had an interview in the media that day. Correct. Want to tell about that?
He was interviewed by the media, and he was carrying his weapon in a low-ready position, and he was asked by the reporter, why are you carrying the weapon like that? And his indication was that he wants to protect the people who he's protesting with, and that, and also he also stated that he was calling the people who would have confronted him with the weapon as pussies, and the police officers, they were just antagonizing them, you know, and so he wanted to prevent that from happening. That's why he carried the weapon around with him.
So the one who had the AK-47, as your son alleges, aimed at his head, have been earlier in the day answering media questions saying, yeah,
yes.
You know, I have this gun because I'm basically trying to protect the people I'm with, and
yes.
and using a crass term to describe people who may not support them.
But he also was using his fiance, wife, girlfriend, I mean, she had different adjectives to their relationship, as he would push her through the crowds or two
vehicles.
She was
in a wheelchair. Yeah.
She was in a wheelchair. He would push her in the wheelchair towards the crowd. She was carrying a trans flag. That was determined also.
And
pointing and pushing people out of the way with the flag is him propelling her towards people who might have interfered with the protest.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I was going to ask you, so in the time your son was in this, turning the corner onto Congress, are you aware of any police presence in that area?
There were police present in that area.
How close?
They were close enough that they were observing for something like this to happen. There was vans. There was a white van that follows them around, and one of the protesters referred the white van as a kidnap van, because if any protesters get out of hand, they were put in that van and taken away from us.
To your knowledge, did any of the police who were fairly close by, did they approach the protesters as they surrounded your
yes.
son's car? Did they try to pull the protesters away or say stop?
They weren't that close, but they were there within minutes. Like, they were observing the corners. I mean, this happened in the corner. There were cameras, there were city cameras that showed, you know, the protesters, what they had done. There was cameras shown with the shooting itself. And,
So didn't this lead, before I forget, on this lead detective in the case, David Fugit, who's really, after the incident occurred, the trial, after the conviction
yes.
occurred, he filed something trying to say that this prosecutor,
yes.
Garza, had committed a crime himself by his withholding
absolutely.
Of evidence.
Absolutely, he was withholding the crime, the incident, because he was the first investigator. Officer Fugit was the first investigator on the scene. So the forensics, everybody was there, and he was the one that was actually there. You know, it was his night to be
yeah.
there. And so he saw from the beginning, gathered all the evidence, gathered all the information that he needed to know to whether to pursue this with an arrest, to report what he had seen, and 900 pages of information he acquired.
Yeah, the 900-page report, again, by Fugit, is after the conviction.
Yeah.
And he's trying to call into question the actual...
That was the initial report, 900 pages. So after the
Of the incident,
absolutely,
pages.
Yes.
Okay. Didn't David Fugit say at some point that the things that were withheld would have caused people to conclude your son should not be prosecuted?
Absolutely.
Okay. So the main guy who's there, witness the first one there, he's saying if a grand jury or the jury got to see everything I saw,
yes.
there wouldn't be a reason for prosecution.
Yes.
But the information was held back by Garza, the
sure.
DA.
Yes.
And then the grand jury can only look at what they have presented,
absolutely.
And the jury can only look at what they're presented with.
That's all they can do. And one of the jurors, I don't know if you wanted to mention this, but one of the jurors actually, we filed for misconduct.
Okay, we're going to get to that in 1 minute.
Sure.
Okay, you know what? I am watching the time, too. We need a magic time machine in the studio. I'm telling my producer here, we need a magic time machine because I can see what's going to happen. We're running out of time, and I want to be sure to get to all these points. But I do want to have, I mean, I think... That fact alone, if you are in appellate court looking at this case And you're realizing that the main investigator, he found the judge's conduct so egregious, the district attorney's conduct so egregious that he actually sought to have criminal charges against the DA to say, you can't hide evidence like this. You can't hide exculpatory evidence. And the DA brought about the firing of this officer.
Absolutely. And this officer still is working in Austin, but that ended his career as a lead detective.
Okay. And that, I mean, it's a staggering case. Okay, let's turn to the other jury misconduct issue, or the jury misconduct issue you mentioned. And you can just go ahead and tell the story, what you know of it.
What I know of is one of the jurors decided to do his own research, and this was between the prosecution's...
Resting his case,
and ours beginning. It's right in the middle. And so this juror decided to do his own research and wanted to find the law, and he Googled something that stated that it is up to the defense to prove innocence rather than the prosecution to find guilt. So on that premise, the jury listened to our case from the defense side with that in mind, and they proceeded to make him guilty because he assumed that was the evidence was legitimate that this juror presented. Now, we filed for mistrial, and the judge says no because it didn't happen during deliberations, you know, guilt or innocence at the end of the trial. So he totally dismissed that. And the juror was interviewed by the judge himself prior to sentencing.
Okay. So I'm going to just encapsulate that again. During the course of the trial, prosecution rests their case. They have to go first in criminal case.
Yes.
A juror had done research on their own and come up with the completely false conclusion that in this case it was the duty of the defendant, the accused, to prove their innocence, which would be an absolute abandonment of the presumption of innocence. You know, the burden of proof is on the prosecutor. But this juror had shared that with the other jurors.
Absolutely. He shared it. It's a paper. He had the paper that he copied from the computer, you know, the...
I'm sorry, newspaper printed this, you're saying?
No, he actually printed this off the computer and submitted it to the...
So and brought it in for the jury to see.
Absolutely.
Okay,
that's what
so juries heard this.
Yes.
And, you know, it's very true that at the end of a trial, you know, the judge gives jury instructions, and they give instructions very specifically, whether it's a civil or criminal case, they run through, especially a criminal case, here's what you must find, and he describes the elements, and each one must be found beyond a reasonable doubt. And so maybe the judge is thinking, well, even if this juror says something incorrect, like the defense has to prove his innocence, that the jury really could have been disabused of that notion because he gave instructions to the jury, which is, to me, the most screaming level example of just jury misconduct.
Absolutely, and also the judge, before every break they had, he mentioned, do not go on the internet, do not do any social media, stay away from the press, and that juror did the total opposite, and God knows how many other jurors did the same thing. I don't know. I don't have any evidence of that, but I'm just saying that whenever there was a break in the day, the judge, obviously nobody listened to him, you know, which makes sense. Do not look at any papers, any social media. Do not interact with the news. And evidently, that was okay.
Yeah.
That was fine. You can do your own research during a trial.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's not okay. And again, you know, I've been trying to talk about this idea a lot on this show recently, which is, I talk quite often, and I know many, many people do, but we're concerned with really the breakdown of rule of law in America. We're concerned about whether or not the premises of our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, especially in this case, the Sixth Amendment, that guarantees you absolutely an impartial jury and a fair trial, which, by the way, that is part of that on the federal level, is the idea that when you know you are when surrounded by a jury that is not impartial, as you are in Washington, D.C., they're 94% Democrat, they're all anti-Trumpers, and yet every January 6th juror, every January 6th case is being tried in front of juries that are, they're all anti what these protesters believe in. And I don't have the exact analogy to make to the Austin jury, but Austin is very liberal. It is known to be very liberal. They continue, I mean, they elected Garza, I guess. I mean, unless it was election fraud, they elected Garza, a guy who's running on you know, kind of anti-police. In fact, I want to throw in some, it's a good point to do this. So part of what Garza did, now he ran on this idea, he was going to find justice for Garrett Foster's family. So he was going to go after and charge Mrs. Perry's son, Daniel Perry. He also announced, and I think it was in 2022, I'm not sure what, I don't have the exact date right here, but the DA, Don, this Garza, Soros-funded DA, announced that he was going to indict, go after 19 police officers, that he wanted them indicted and prosecuted over what he characterized as their, you know, too rough, too brute, whatever his word was. You know, they were too harsh in how they treated the protesters in the 2020 protests, in the George Floyd protests that proceeded from the George Floyd incident in Minneapolis. So he, this DA, has indicted 19 police officers, which is a pretty big wide swath of police officers, and caused great confusion in the media because he announced it before he had indictments, and so these people were all relieved of their jobs. And you begin to see what happens when you have agenda-driven attorneys, agenda-driven prosecutors. They are deciding it's more important to fulfill my commitment to the voters, my commitment, I'm going to go after the police. I mean, he's a, you know, the mindset of defund the police or, you know, reduce their power. And so it's another indicia of how he sees the world. His job is to make police look bad. So I don't know what's happened in those cases. I could try to follow up on all of them. But there's a lot of mindset about the prosecutor himself that plays into all of this, plays into all of it. I want to read one little quote, by the way. This is from, again, this Travis County lead investigator, the police detective, who is trying to point out, and this guy's name is David Fugit, trying to point out, he did a long affidavit pointing out things like having several conversations with the district attorney's office regarding evidence that could have been favorable to Perry, but it became clear to me that the DA's office did not want to present this evidence, ordered to remove more than 100 slides from his presentation, and he felt like he had no other option but to comply with their order. So you have a, I mean, there are examples I could read, but this is, it's prosecutorial bias to a point. He was just kind of trying to conclude, you know, there's a, we're going to get this guy, and we're not going to let evidence be heard by the grand jury or the jury that might allow them to get a fuller picture of what occurred that night. Okay. I think I might interrupt you. Do you have another point you want to go to?
You have the perfect picture. You did a great job, you know.
Well, good. Okay. Thank you. So is your son, so conviction has occurred. So is it on appeal?
Yes, my son's still in Travis County Jail because it's a misdemeanor charge. I think it's an endangerment or something like that because he drove his vehicle not knowing there was a protest, because protest was not sanctioned by the police. There was no permit for it. So my son had no idea this was happening. And the premeditation is absurd because my son does not follow protests. He does not, I mean, he was just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he ran up upon a person who doesn't want anything to do with this prosecution misdemeanor charge. She said that her life was not in danger. And she said that, you know, she lives in Pennsylvania right now. The one that supposedly my son tried to run over. He was going 6 miles an hour. He couldn't run over
anything.
6 miles
an hour.
Couldn't have been trying.
Okay. I want to hit two other points. Making myself little notes here. One is, I know that in the course of this trial, there were social media postings by your son that were, the jury was exposed to. And, you know, they were, I will say, critical of Black Lives Matter movement, you know, which a lot of people are critical of Black Lives Matter movement. They were social media posts that may have convinced the jury that, you know, what his motive was in the time he entered. And that's
it was just one-sided. They only let him present, the jury only saw Daniel's responses to what the other soldiers were saying. The soldiers were of all colors. It wasn't racially motivated, his responses. It was just,
there was a conversation. Sorry.
I mean, my son is, we're Jewish, and so my son was told that, you know, your people are going to be burnt, let's burn your Jews or something like that. And he responded, well, you know, I mean, let's drown all the babies that are mixed race or something like that was in there. It was just bantering back and forth. Nobody was offended that he was responding this to.
The banter was on some social media, private chat kind of thing?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, so those got in, and it's kind of interesting.
More, and everything was released after the trial to put like a nail, one more nail in my son's coffin of things that had nothing to do with, all of it is out of context, because the person he responded to, none of their social media was exposed. So it's only one-sided.
So they're only saying his answer is not knowing what he's responding to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, this is, again, a prosecutor who is just going to get this guy. That's his, you know, and actually, I had this conversation with, you know, in California, I practice law in a major law firm. I had a good friend who was a DA. She was a prosecutor. She's a great woman. Anyway, she would make the point that, you know, as she's prosecuting a case, you know, the defense's job is to get your guy off, period. The prosecutor's job is never supposed to be get a conviction. I know that is what it is appears to be, but the prosecutor's job is actually to seek justice and to be keep your eyes open, your thought open, to even during the course of a trial, if you begin to recognize, hey, there's this other evidence here that kind of calls into question my theory of this case, calls into question my, you know, what charge, whether a jury should find this person guilty. I mean, there's a duty of a prosecutor different from the duty of a defense lawyer. The prosecutor's job is to seek justice, which in some cases may mean actually deciding in the course of the trial to reduce charges, to even drop the case. They're supposed to seek truth, justice, not just seek convictions. And you get the sense from this case that this prosecutor decided, I ran on getting this guy, I'm going to keep evidence away that I don't want the jury to hear, I'm going to let things in without a full context. It just has a, I'm tired of the word witch hunt, but it has an agenda-driven vengeance feel to it about this case. So Greg Abbott, our great governor, our governor of Texas, said at the time he was going to, as quickly as possible, he was going to seek to pardon your son. But he's required to get first a report from the, I think it's Bureau of Paroles and whatever it's called.
Yes, the Bureau, the Parole Board.
The Parole Board, yeah.
That he's actually elected the people on the Parole Board.
So. He appointed them.
Yes.
And okay,
he has to hear from them first prior, but I mean, if I can get any letters written or anything written to the Parole Board requesting my son's release, that would be wonderful as well.
Okay, yeah. That was one thing I was going to ask you, and I didn't know the answer to this very moment. So Governor Abbott said he was going to seek to pardon this person, Daniel Perry, but he has to first get a report from a board, a Parole Board, which he appoints all the members of, and then the governor's office has been pretty quiet in the last, since this time.
Yes.
We're now, I don't know how many weeks actually we are after, but we're getting to the end of May. And so there is a desire, if you feel concerned about this case, to contact. You can submit a letter to the
Texas Board of Paroles.
And you know what, folks? I don't know how to do that, but I'm going to find that out, and I'll tell you in the next show, because I don't know how to do that right now. But I think letters that just encourage them, because I think it's amazing to think, and I say this in so many contexts, you know, when your kids are growing up, you teach them, don't succumb to peer pressure. Think for yourself. Reason for yourself. Find your own facts. This peer pressure, this desire to go along, to get along, to not fight the left-wing narrative, this peer pressure and this massive leftist push in this country, mm-hmm. anti-police mentality, it really has actually impacted cases. I truly believe the judges in the federal court system in Washington, D.C., are swayed by what everyone has told them they're supposed to think about January 6 defendants, rather than the facts in those cases, rather than the rule of law, rather than stepping back and looking at the vengeance the DOJ has embraced in going after these people. Peer pressure impacts everyone, even judges, even lawyers, even prosecutors, even people in the parole board in Texas. So if you're so inclined, I will get an address and tell you where you can send your comment. One last thing, is there any other way people can help you?
Basically just a lot of prayer, and just writing to the parole board requesting for my son's release. The more this goes international, the better we are, because it seems like his case has been swept underneath the carpet here and not enough people are responding to it, know about it. I just pray that, you know, this will resolve itself, and he's innocent. I would not be here sitting here trying to defend the son if he was guilty or if he was malicious anyway. But social media actually convicted my son. You know, he was convicted by the social media more than anything else.
Yeah, I give a little bit of credit to the mindset of George Soros and getting prosecutors in who just don't have this Let's have a neutral rule of law that applies to everybody. Because if they did, they would have been prosecuting the people who were attacking the car, prosecuting the person who shot at the car, prosecuting other people who were in any way violent.
Yes.
But all that really seemed to happen in those massive protests of 2020, those kind of people, even arrests were made, prosecutions didn't happen. And, you know, I will say another comment about the police down there. This really began even when I mentioned earlier when Donald Trump was running in 2015 and 2016, and he would plan some event, you know, some big rally, whatever it was. And I'm not a big rally goer, but, you know, you see them on the news. So, you know, thousands show up, they're at a rally. And early on in Trump's campaign, the left organized against him. It was Black Lives Matter, it was Antifa. Many leftist mob-oriented organizations organized against Trump. They would show up outside, they were screaming and yelling and waving signs, intimidating people who wanted to go in and hear Donald Trump speak. And very few arrests happened. And if arrests happened, prosecutions didn't happen. So it was just kind of a, we began this process of giving permission to one political side to do pretty much what they want to do. And that carried over, because obviously that was occurring in 2015 and 2016, that the leftist rioters and protesters in this country were kind of treated to a blanket different standard than other Americans about what will tolerate, what will allow you to do, whether or not you'll be prosecuted. And it really continues to be carried over to this incident in July of 2020 in Austin. We have had, you know, you can protest in this country, you can get permits. I do love, you know, peaceful protest marches. It's part of the First Amendment. I love it. But you get permission for where you can march. You're told, yes, you can march on this street or in this park, whatever it is. Your permit tells you where you can go. And, you know, you can wave, you can give speeches and wave flags or wave signs. But we've allowed in this country the standard of justice, standard of what's permissible as to protests, to be different. A different standard applies if you're on the anti-American left, which is you can pretty much do what you want. You can disrupt, break things, burn buildings, and nothing happens to you. And so really, as protests continue, like right now we're at a fairly peaceful phase, but as protests otherwise occur, you know, we have taught the more violent left that you really don't have to comply with the way we do ordered liberty in America, the way we have a First Amendment and freedom of speech. The rule doesn't really apply to you because, after all, you're on the right side, you're on the left, and so we're going to let